It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new school year is underway, and most superintendents are likely to tell you that their top priority, even above the achievement of their students, is a safe learning environment, the security of their schools. How do local and federal authorities respond, even try to head off threats? Bob Jones is the special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Agent Jones, welcome back to the Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Good to be back.
I was looking at data from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and it indicated that school bomb threats have increased 33% in the last 5 years. That's nationwide. Do those numbers reflect what's happening in the Pittsburgh region, would you say?
Sure. That sort of reflects a national trend. Most of our threats are not bomb threats that we see. They're more mass shooting threats. Those are all collected at our criminal justice information system, NTOC, in West Virginia, and we've seen about a one-third uptick in the last couple of weeks following El Paso and Dayton.
Last couple of weeks, and that's nationwide or also in the region that you cover?
That is nationwide, mm-hmm. But that reflects this region as well.
All right. So any sense is why there are more threats, whether they're bomb or mass shooting threats? Is it one begets another?
We always see an uptick following a large actual event. So we know that these August increases are probably based, again, on El Paso and Dayton.
Mm-hmm. Fortunately, most bomb threats turn out to be hoaxes. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
But even false bomb threats have major impacts.
Sure.
Correct? And how so?
They are inherently dangerous. We respond with our state, local, and campus and tribal partners to every threat, regardless of seriousness. So, I mean, just take a potential school threat. You have children and possibly teachers evacuating that are converging with law enforcement officers that are responding with a mindset that this could potentially result in violent action. That is inherently dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And there's an impact on the school, the disruption, and even a cost factor of first responders.
Absolutely. We expend a substantial amount of manpower on these, as do local law enforcement. A day off from school has to be made up at some point, so they are all very consequential.
How are threats these days usually delivered, whether it's a shooting threat or a bomb threat? What's the vehicle for the message?
Most of what we see is on social media, people that post something on social media. Just numerous accounts over the last couple of days where schools and houses of worship and other public places have threats made against them by somebody posting something to a social media platform.
Is that the easiest way? Is that the easiest way for mass distribution of the threat?
I think it is. It also is certainly influenced by the willing or the desire of the person to remain anonymous. It's much easier for someone to put something out there on social media and not have to kind of cross that threshold of picking up a phone or mailing a letter.
So the handwritten note can be more easily traced as you do investigations?
Certainly. We obviously can't monitor all social media. Most of the threats that we see are people that noticed something and then they contact us to say, hey, this particular person that's posting something that looks a little bit disturbing.
Can you tell us a bit about the procedure for law enforcement, local, state, federal, your office, when a threat is made, bomb versus shooting, it doesn't matter?
Sure. Again, what we see, a threat will come into our National Threat Operations Center down in West Virginia. That threat will be relayed to the local field office. If it's something in the Pittsburgh area, the NTOC will call me, and then most often I will contact that local law enforcement organization, that police department, that will at least do the initial investigation or response.
What happens when the threat is made, in a sense, made locally, not just to a local school, we're using schools as an example, but made that way, and maybe the school district is the first to notice it? Do they contact you? How does the FBI get involved then?
Yes, we have the FBI.tips.gov tips line that people can contact. They can call our office. Again, if it looks like something that has a federal nexus, we'll continue that investigation. But most often, those cases are resolved at the local level.
But is your expertise then wanted for the actual investigation after the threat is mitigated one way or another?
Correct. I think that probably the interesting thing worthy of mention now is we're starting to see a lot of prosecutions, even for the hoax threats, people that are actually being hauled into court, arrested, and prosecuted for uttering these threats, both at a state and federal level.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is it at the state court system or is it the federal court system?
It all depends on state law. But again, based on the nature of the threat and the increase in these, we're starting to see a lot of local departments and prosecutors that are taking these all the way and not allowing these people off with a warning.
Mm-hmm. As far as a bomb threat goes, does it result in an evacuation every time, or are there cases when a lockdown might be more appropriate?
I don't have the data on that, but mm-hmm. we do see schools especially that are siding with caution and evacuating or canceling school for the day, even though they probably think that it's a hoax. They're just not going to take the chance, so they'll evacuate the building or cancel. They need to.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Bob Jones. He's the special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Even if a sweep of a school or university building comes up negative for an explosive device, is there the possibility of injury even in the evacuation or lockdown?
Absolutely. Again, what we'll see is numerous students and teachers evacuating, if that's the process. And then you've got law enforcement officers responding that do not know that this is a hoax, who are preparing themselves mentally for what could be a violent encounter. Again, the opportunity for misidentification or a mistake is just much higher in a tension-filled situation like that. So that's what we worry about with these hoax threats.
And even the evacuation could be accidental, even if it's done as orderly as possible. There can be some anxiety and, you know, rushing and even tripping and falling. That's kind of potential for injury as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
How is the procedure, if it is different at all, different in a university setting? An example, at Pitt, where it's a research facility, they also have dozens of labs and deep collection of some of the world's most deadly diseases. What is the approach when there's a threat, especially a bomb threat, that might be able to release some of these very dangerous elements, viruses? What's the procedure there?
Sure. That's a great question. We would respond initially as we would to any threat. I have a weapons of mass destruction coordinator who conducts lots of outreach with universities. If we saw a threat specific to a facility like that, we would probably take it a little bit more seriously. We tend to see less hoax threats on college campuses because the kids are a little bit more mature. But that would ratchet up at least our investigative phase a little bit if it was related to something like that.
You mentioned a little bit earlier about prosecutions seeming to be more prevalent now. I believe it was after Columbine that several states, including Pennsylvania, either adopted new laws or amended old ones regarding bomb threats, hoax bomb threats, and even making so the criminal penalty for doing it, but even making parents financially responsible for a minor who issued a fake bomb threat. Do you think that any of that is having any impact on averting? I mean, is that even measurable?
I don't think it's measurable. That's very difficult to measure at all. But again, what we are seeing is folks taking it a little bit more seriously. We try to speak to groups of parents, educators, and school districts to make sure they understand that the seriousness of these types of threats.
Right. So give us an example of parents. How do you meet them? Is it after the fact, or do you have like community meetings occasionally to talk about this and even alert to try to find out what might your child be thinking?
Sure. We have a very robust and effective outreach platforms, many different outreach platforms. And anytime we have a chance to get in front of a group of educators or parents, we'll bring up hoax threats, how to talk to your kids, how to watch what they're sending out, how to think before they post something to social media. And we don't like to threaten, but we will mention things that you just mentioned, that parents could be liable and that these things are taken seriously. And even a juvenile could be looking at a potential jail sentence for threats. Just in the last couple of days, we've had two, one in Mississippi and one in Florida, where we arrested juveniles, not federally. One was federal, one was mm-hmm. local, and they will probably see some substantial penalties.
In addition to those community meetings with parents, what else can you do? What is being done to try to reduce the number of threats, shooting threats, bomb threats, before they even happen?
Well, I just think it's an education process with these young folks. We have to try to make sure they understand the ramifications of their actions, and then the general deterrence and specific deterrence piece of it is something that we look at too. I don't want to put any young person in jail, but that may be what it takes to ensure that everybody understands the seriousness of these potential threats.
There's that campaign that's been going on for a while, if you see something, say something. That's still a reactive kind of action, though, is it not? Because you're seeing something and you're saying, uh-oh, could this be a problem, as opposed to a proactive?
Sure. Unfortunately, we're not in the mental health business. We can certainly have our behavioral analysis unit people from Quantico help us put out some information on predictors. But that's normally will fall into the realm of what a school district or another educational facility should sort of work on.
Just about 20 seconds or so. I'm reading into that we could use some more resources for mental health evaluation and treatment.
Absolutely. I don't think it's too early to do that in any young person's life if they show symptoms of a requirement.
Bob Jones is the special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh office of the FBI. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. The highest-ranking positions in corporate America don't always reflect the talent pool. A new local academy is working to better opportunities for African-American professionals to break into the C-suite in the Pittsburgh region. And just ahead, 8 months after a fire at the Clairton Coke Works site, a federal lawsuit claims U.S. Steel withheld required data after their pollution control equipment was knocked out. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
When Stevie Ray Vaughan walked on stage at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1982, he and his band Double Trouble didn't have a recording contract. In fact, they didn't even have any recorded material. None of that mattered, though, because within a year of that performance, Vaughan had been given free rein of Jackson Browne's studio, recorded a few big songs with David Bowie, and had a hit album out himself. Stevie Ray was one of those rare talents who made a major impact in such a short time. On this day in 1990, Stevie Ray Vaughan died in a helicopter crash, leaving the Alpine Valley Music Theater. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A Christmas Eve fire last year at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works knocked out pollution controls for more than 3 months. Now the Clean Air Council and the Environmental Integrity Project have filed suit in federal court in Pittsburgh against the steelmaker. Allegheny Front reporter Reed Frazier covers energy and environment issues for State Impact Pennsylvania. Reed, welcome back to The Confluence.
Hi, Kevin.
Reed, in this suit, the actual release of untreated emissions or something else, is that what the suit is about, or is it about information?
It's mainly about information. There's other litigation around, you know, the pollution that this plant was causing. The allegation in this suit is that the company under the basically what's known as the Superfund law had an obligation to report releases of hazardous substances to a federal database, the amount and kind of pollution that it was releasing into the community, and that they didn't. And they're trying to compel the company to release this information.
I think many of us would think of Superfund law and they'd be thinking about dumping and spillages, but maybe not necessarily emissions.
Yeah. I mean, you think of Superfund, you think of, like, I don't know, barrels of radioactive waste leaking into the ground. But part of the law includes provisions for community, notification about, any kind of environmental pollution.
So why was this suit filed 8 months after the fire first happened?
Well, according to the lawsuit, the groups looked for the information. They actually, according to their lawsuit, they asked U.S. Steel for the information. They did not find it in the the federally available data that's kept on these releases. And so they're filing suit to compel the company to do this.
So who exactly is supposed to receive this information, this data?
It's something called the National Response Center, which is run by the U.S. Coast Guard. U.S. Coast Guard. And normally, I mean, it's for like oil spills, think the BP spill in the Gulf or something like that. But, you know, there's thousands of these spills a day in the U.S., and this is a way for the public to know what's getting out in the environment.
Are they just a repository for information, or do they actually do something, this center, do something with that info?
No, it's mainly, it's not a regulatory agency. It funnels the information to the appropriate agencies, whether it's the EPA or the DEP or someone else.
All right, so they are the conduit for the information.
Yeah, it's just like a searchable, it also creates a kind of an instant accountability for the public about what's getting out in the environment.
U.S. Steel did report sulfur emissions to local regulators, didn't they, though?
They did. They were reporting their emissions of sulfur dioxide, which is a major pollutant from the plant, to the Allegheny County Health Department as the outage was ongoing in the months of January, February, March. But they were not reporting releases of other kinds of pollution. These are so-called hazardous air pollutants. They include things like benzene, which is a known human carcinogen, hydrogen sulfide, which is a nose and throat irritant and can make breathing very difficult. So there's sort of a cornucopia of chemicals that get out when these outages occur. And some of those chemicals were not being reported on, allegedly, according to the lawsuit, according to the law.
Is the U.S. Steel commenting on this suit?
Citing sort of precedent that they don't comment on lawsuits. They are not commenting on the lawsuit. They maintain they are committed to environment, community, and so forth.
And just about 20 seconds or so, this is not the only suit the company is facing. Remind us what the suit is by Allegheny County.
Well, they're suing over the actual air pollution that was caused by this release, and they're joined by several environmental groups. And so that will be, probably a long negotiation, maybe a settlement in the future.
Allegheny Front reporter Reid Frazier covers energy and environment issues for State Impact Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for joining us today, Reid.
You're welcome.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Only three of the nation's Fortune 500 companies are run by African Americans. That's down from eight in 2015. And the ratios in Pittsburgh aren't much better. How can we ensure our region's companies and organizations are more representative of our society? A new program is underway to help African-American professionals break into the top executive ranks at Pittsburgh corporations. Joining us now to talk about the Executive Leadership Academy are Robert Young, he's the Managing Director of the Advanced Leadership Initiative, and three of the recent graduates of the Academy. Tafoi Kamara is Administrative Director for UPMC's Aging Institute. Marlon Ferguson is Executive Director of Veterans Place. And Mashika Jones-Slack is Vice President for Quality and Safety at Allegheny Health Network. Thanks to all of you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Robert, let's start with you.
Absolutely.
How would you assess the current environment, the opportunities for mid-level African-American professionals to reach that C-suite that we often talk about?
Absolutely. When we have a conversation about Pittsburgh, we often identify it as the home to leading hospitals, self-driving cars, world-renowned universities, but Pittsburgh's truly trailing in one key area, and that's leadership diversity. When you look at the statistics, regionally African-Americans represent about 24% of the population here in Pittsburgh, 13% here in Allegheny County, yet African-Americans represent less than 1% of executive leadership, significantly disproportionate to our region. And with that, Pittsburgh truly does need a pipeline of African-American talent prepared for the challenges and responsibilities of executive leadership here in Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh that's evolving today.
Mm-hmm. Marlon, Tafoy, Mashika, what barriers, obstacles, challenges have you faced on your way in progressing during your career? Marlon, we'll start with you.
Well, my background is pretty varied. I've worked in corporate, nonprofit, higher ed. And for me, one of the barriers, I always call it the barrier of low expectation. You know, it's like you're always pushing against a wall, trying to, you know, constantly prove yourself when the standards for maybe your contemporary, you know, maybe a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was really kind of challenging. And also, it was interesting. I was getting recruited more so. I was getting heavily recruited to leave Pittsburgh from other areas. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was really kind of interesting. It's like, wow, other people can see the value that I have in other areas. Why not Pittsburgh?
Mm-hmm. Mashika?
Well, so I am fairly new to the area, right? But I've been in healthcare for about 25 years now. And the barriers that I've faced in many of my roles, it seems that it transcends states, right? So much of the same as Marlon, that double standard that it seems like we're faced with, you know, it's less room for error for African Americans, but also the microaggressions that I believe as an African American I've faced over the years, the implicit biases that I've also faced as an African American in leadership over the years. I think it transcends. And even though I'm fairly new to the area, and I say fairly new to the area because I've only been here for about a year and a half, mm-hmm. I still sense some of those same types of barriers in this area, right? So for me, that's why the TALI program was very much of an interest of mine to really understand, you know, how do I begin to really overcome these things, right? I've seen these things in other leadership programs. I've seen addressing some of these things in other leadership programs, but never with a cohort of African Americans solely in the program.
Tafoy.
I think there's an element of hiding in plain sight for African American leaders in the area. So this has been an opportunity to really underscore the incredible talent that we have, really say these are individuals that are passionate about this area, that have invested in this area, and have these tremendous skills and talents that need to be injected back into leadership. So surprisingly, that was an element that I was shocked to discover, you know, being a part of TALI, how I was surrounded by so many individuals that I wasn't familiar with. And so that's an important piece.
We're talking about the so-called C-suite. That's referring to the top senior staffers in an organization, all starting with CEO, Chief Executive Officer, Chief Operating Officer, Chief Information Officer. To any of you, why are these jobs specifically so tough to break into?
Well, so I'll start. I believe that for these roles, absolutely, as African Americans, we have to be qualified, right? That is the prerequisite for entry into these roles. We have to be qualified. And for some, that's enough. That's enough to break into these C-suite roles. But for many African Americans, it is not. We also need sponsorship. So when you think about the Pittsburgh area and when you think about the statistics that Robert mentioned, with 23% African American in this area and less than 1% in the C-suite role, we're just not visible. We don't have the exposure. So we need sponsorship. It's not just about qualifications for African Americans. It's also about someone speaking on our behalf when we're not in the room. And I believe that as African American leaders, that's often something that we're missing.
Marlon.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation about a year ago, and I have a friend. I was in the Navy, and I also played ball in college, and I was talking to one of my Navy friends, and he was saying that, you know, wow, you know, President Obama made it to the White House, so basically racism is annihilated. It's gone. And for me, it's just the lack of understanding of, you know, yeah, one man made it to the White House. But no, we still have a lot of miles to travel. We still have a lot of things to overcome. But it's that understanding. It's like, well, you know, there is not equal access. There's not equal understanding. And for me, it's disappointing because, you know, I'm an athlete. I'm used to competing, you know. And so for me, I don't want anybody to lower the plank, you know, the standards for me. Just give me equal access and opportunity. And you find that it's not. You don't always have the avenues that some of your colleagues have. And, you know, it's frustrating. For me, Tally gave us some resources to help us understand that and navigate that.
We'll talk about the Academy in just a moment, but I want to follow up on something you just said. Do you feel, any of you, that your ambition, your drive, your energy, your skills are being rewarded or not? Halfway.
You know, I think, again, it's a matter of really coming out from under this bushel, you know, to really sort of showcase the talent that is in the area. You know, I personally was just taken by the other cohort members and the tremendous skills that they brought and such. And, you know, as I was saying before, there's a matter of really making sure that that is visible. And that folks are aware. It's a small community, and so that's something that we benefit from in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. you know, and so we want to make sure that our talent is showcased.
Mm-hmm. Mashika?
Yeah, so absolutely agree with Tafoy. The program has really provided that visibility and exposure that I think is so important to the African-American community, especially in light of the fact that the demographics are so different. I think it's also important for organizations to do the same things for African-Americans. They have to intentionally provide the exposure and the visibility and the training for all of those African-Americans who are qualified to lead in the organizations. It has to be an intentional effort. Otherwise, it's the hidden in plain sight that Tafoy mentioned earlier.
We'll hear more about the Advanced Leadership Initiative, TALI, when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guests are Robert Young of the Advanced Leadership Initiative and three graduates of the first cohort at the Executive Leadership Academy, Tafoy Kamara, Marlon Ferguson, and Mashika Jones-Slack. Robert, how can the Advanced Leadership Initiative help, and why did you see the Academy as a way to do that?
Exactly. So Evan Frazier, who's the founding director and senior vice president of community affairs of Highmark Health, saw the need that both Marlon, Tafoy, and Mashika have shared and really socialized the concept of the Executive Leadership Academy and provided the opportunity to socialize this concept of how do we develop this pipeline of African-American executive leadership? And through conversations with community leaders, stakeholders, and others, he developed a leadership team who now represent Greg Spencer of Randall Industries, Jerry McClary of Covestro, Marsha Jones of PNC, Kenya Boswell of BNY Mellon, and Clarence Dozier of FedEx Ground, who all lead the strategic direction of TALI. But the critical component of the Executive Leadership Academy was to partner with a world-class institution. It was critical to build that foundation so that these individuals could experience a world-class curriculum from both Tepper faculty as well as faculty throughout the nation to gain the hard skills that are needed for executives to rise through the ranks of corporate America and in the Pittsburgh business region.
7-month program. Give us a brief description of what's involved.
Right. So it's a 7-month program, and they've mentioned one of the key pillars, which is executive sponsorship. Each cohort member is paired with a C-suite individual here in the region that provides them the opportunity to build a relationship beyond their organization. That executive sponsor really opens their sphere of influence to each cohort member. The second is the seven-month world-class curriculum cohort experience, and third, the executive coaching. So throughout that 7 months, cohort members receive the hard skills in terms of business accounting, utilizing big data, innovative thinking, but also having the opportunity to learn how to leverage networks of influence. You know, how do I approach implicit bias? How do I navigate those feelings of isolation within my organization? But also, how do I build a network of other African-American executives that help transition and transform both my personal and professional identity as it progresses through my career?
Mashika and Marlon and Tafoy, specifically on implicit bias, was it addressed in the seven-month program the way you expected? Were there any surprises, if you would?
Certainly. I mean, addressed not only in terms of the data and the research and such, but having, you know, there were 23 of us all together, having our peers be able to speak about their personal experiences over the years. I mean, we represent corporate corporations, nonprofit, governmental, entrepreneurial spheres. And so we all brought a wealth of experiences. And that was tremendous to be able to share that information and learn from each other's experiences.
Mashika?
Yeah, so absolutely, again, to agree with Tafoy's take on this. I believe that the implicit biases that we face in the workplace impact our performance significantly. And I believe that there was this awareness and affirmation of that going through the program, right? And with that awareness and affirmation, it sort of gave me the ability personally to be able to begin to overcome those biases, because now I know that it truly does, based on research, impact how you perform, right? And how you perform can certainly impact your ability to progress in the organization. And so what I really appreciate about the program is not only did we have discourse around this, conversation around these implicit biases, but we really did walk away with the tools and the resources that we needed to be able to overcome it so that we can perform at the highest level, because we are very qualified candidates.
Mm-hmm. Marlon, how is the curriculum designed specifically to speak to the experience of African Americans? I'd like Robert to chime in as well.
Well, for me, one of the most impactful sessions was the first session we had, where the data was laid out, national data. And so much, in fact, it was really exasperating to me because, you know, to have your experiences quantified, and that it's actually, yeah, these things are happening, and there's data to support the experiences and the things that you're feeling, for me was really impactful. And it was actually kind of comforting after a while, because you think, like for me personally, I'm thinking, you know, am I going crazy? You know, is this what's happening? And then actually I have the data on the wall saying that, hey, you're not going crazy.
And you're not alone in experiencing this.
And you're not alone, right.
Yeah. Robert.
Yes. Yeah, so the each module provided both an opportunity for our faculty members through the Tepper School of Business to provide that hard data, but also provided a safe space for our cohort members to have that conversation around the data and theory that was being presented, but also how they applied that to themselves, how they applied that to their organization, and then the macro business community here in Pittsburgh. You know, I'd be remiss to not thank our colleagues at the Tepper School of Business, Dean Damon, for really administering a fantastic program, one that is innovative and groundbreaking, and we're seeing the results immediately in the changes that each cohort member has experienced and articulated.
We have just a couple minutes left. Do you think Pittsburgh companies are doing enough to fulfill promises, pledges to be more diverse, more representative of our community?
I think this is a tremendous start. You know, there's certainly been initiatives that have been in place, but this has really injected some incredible excitement into those initiatives. But this is just the beginning. You know, there's quite a long way to go. And I think that Tally has been a great way to really sort of galvanize those efforts.
Mashika.
Yeah. And so I believe that if we're going to really change the atmosphere and the culture in this city, organizations are going to have to do more, right? They're going to have to be very intentional within their strategic plans, not the strategic plans 5 years from now, but the more immediate strategic plans a year from now. What am I really going to do organizationally to commit to systemic change, to impact how individuals, qualified individuals, African-American individuals show up in the organization. There has to be a greater commitment. It has to be intentional. It has to move beyond just a quota from a diversity and inclusion perspective. We have to really have tangible activities around how am I going to make it equitable, to Marlon's point, to make sure that when we get in the C-suite roles, we're not having to navigate all of these biases that we mentioned earlier.
And Marlon.
Well, I just think it's in the best interest of the region for the leadership to really understand that they're not capitalizing on a tremendous pool of talent. I think for us to be competitive in the world, we have to utilize all of our resources, and to marginalize a group of people with such great talent, I just think it runs counter to best practices, competition, being the best. You know, I know in my cohort, I had the opportunity to interact with some amazing people, and to have, you know, us marginalized, I just think is not in the best interest of the region.
And very briefly, Robert, the next class begins in January.
The next class begins in January.
What's the application process
2020?
Like?
The application deadline is October 1st. They can visit advancedleadershipinitiative.org. To find more about the Executive Leadership Academy and to apply.
And Mashika, just one more. What would you do? Would you suggest others apply?
Absolutely. It's been a phenomenal experience.
Mashika Jones-Slack is Vice President, Quality and Safety, Allegheny Health Network. Marlon Ferguson is Executive Director of Veterans Place. Tafoy Kamara is Administrative Director, UPMC Aging Institute. And Robert Young is the Managing Director of the Advanced Leadership Initiative. Thanks so much for all of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
In June of last year, WESA General Manager John Sutton asked Megan Harris, Kylie Kaczynski, and me to create, develop, and produce a daily news program in which we'd hear from newsmakers, difference makers in our community, and have conversations about issues vital to our region. Well, we'll try to do just that. On August 27th, 2018, the Confluence debuted on a daily basis. Today marks our first anniversary. Over the last 12 months, we've presented 234 shows. We'd like to thank the more than 700 guests who have appeared on the Confluence and for the support from our colleagues at WESA and WYEP and our wonderful interns through the course of the last 12 months, Avery Keatley, Mick Stinelli, Alex Linnigan, Julia Zankovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. And special thanks to you, the listeners. Please keep those comments coming and suggestions for guests and topics. Email them confluence@wesa.fm. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zankovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. You've probably heard me say a time or two that the Confluence is where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I hope that's true, but I can assure you that Megan Harris and Kylie Kaczynski are where and how the Confluence comes together every day. Thanks, partners. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.